Welcome to our second episode of A Journey into Excellence, an ongoing monthly series where experts in their field will focus on how evidence-based promotion of life, liberty, and happiness pursuit requires clear thinking and civility in our family, education, and leadership management systems. My name is Vernon Bohr, and I'll be your host for the next hour and a half. Our panel consists of John Spence, one of the top business thought leaders and leadership development experts in the world, who's done extensive work on public, on business and personal excellence, has written several books on these topics, blogs regularly on topics, and has been a TEDx speaker and regularly produces seminars on business leadership skills. Also, we have Martin Haysacker, PhD. Dr. Haysacker is a professor of psychology at the University of Florida. He has served as chair for the University of Florida's Department of Psychology, as well as numerous other boards and committees, and is a highly published author in many scientific journals. We also have Brian P. Higley, PhD. Dr. Higley is president and CEO of the Building Blocks to Excellence company. It's an LLC. It's a company that focuses on promoting team excellence, personal effectiveness, and work life satisfaction in individuals, teams, and organizations. Dr. Higley has worked with a wide range of organizations, has served as an executive coach in individuals, across a variety of industries, and has taught psychology at colleges and universities across the nation. And last but not least, Jack Malcolm. Jack is the president of Falcon Performance Group, an organization dedicated to improving the professionalism, preparation, and productivity of sales professionals in the complex sales environment. On today's show, Marty, Brian, and Jack, and it's possible John might join us later, will start by reviewing the importance of civility and clear thinking and helping ourselves and others to flourish within the family, education, and leadership management systems. They will then define three specific logical fallacies that often disrupt flourishing by promoting abuse, confusion, and lack of trust. These are false cause, straw man arguments, and ad hominem attacks. And finally, our experts will provide us with some specific activities that we can engage in to minimize the negative impact of these three huge barriers to happy and healthy families, satisfying and useful educational experiences, and profitable and helpful organizations. So with that, could you pick up the call, Dr. Higley?
I apologize for that. I'm trying to.
That's okay.
I'm trying to text my daughter in Seattle to tell her I'll call her later.
No problem.
We are working on family systems, so family systems do pop into our lives every once in a while, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they absolutely do. So with that, Brian, let's start with you. Take us away. Take us into the show.
Okay, yeah.
Start.
That sounds great. So what I figured I'd do is very quickly ground ourselves and our listeners in some of the stuff that we talked about in our initial episode and sort of take it from there. So to me, the journey into excellence brings up in my mind my own journeys into the three systems that you referenced in the intro, Vern, the family system, the education system, and the leadership system. And just as a reminder of how I journeyed into those systems, I journeyed into those systems in three different ways. Initially as a student of those systems, then as a teacher within those systems, and then after that as a sort of teacher of teachers or consultant to consultants within those three systems. And each time I journeyed into those systems, I was tracking the degree to which what is happening in those systems seemed to me to align with the scientific literature on learning, change, and growth. And what I found so often, and what so many people who I was journeying through these systems noticed as well, is that what is happening in those systems very frequently does not align with what is best for human beings and what is best for systems. So one of the things that excites me so much about this journey into excellence is that we get to have a look at that and talk about it with ourselves and talk about it with other people as well. And so, Vern, when you and I were initially talking about this, Marty, John, and Jack were some of the first people that came to my mind, because over the decades we have been having discussions about this individually. And so what we wanted to do with this podcast is make those individual discussions a group discussions amongst the five of us, and also to let anybody else in on those discussions who wanted to listen to them. So that's really what the objectives, for me at least, are for this journey into excellence and what the focus is. And what I thought I'd do is return to your great question, Vern, in the first episode, what is excellence? Because I think there's one of the big issues in family systems, in education systems, and in leadership systems is people will talk about excellence, but they won't actually define what excellence is. And so last episode, I put forth the notion that excellence is achieved when your activities lead to goals and your goals lead to visions that are obviously helpful to yourself and others, or helpful to ourselves and others, and that's why I use the acronym H2O. Excellence is H2O, because excellence to me is things that are helpful to both ourselves and others. What I noticed very often in the systems that weren't, at least to me, very well aligned with the scientific literature on H2O-related stuff, is that the reasoning behind that misalignment very often came back to what Jack had been writing a lot about over the years, and he's our lean communication expert, our concise communication expert, and I think he really nailed it when he was writing about civility and clear thinking. Those are the two things that I found to be most highly correlated with systems that were most helpful to self and others, and that poor thinking and lack of civility were so often correlated with unhelpful families, unhelpful education systems, and unhelpful leadership and management systems. So what I thought I would pitch to the group, and we did this over email in between the last episode and this one, is at least a segment, and if the segment turns into the entire journey, that's fine with me personally, a segment called Excellence as Clear Thinking and Civility, where we would dive into some of the barriers to clear thinking and some of the barriers to civility as well. And what I thought I would do is, after I'm done talking here, is to pitch the discussion over to Marty, who might be able to talk about how some of this is disrupting the family system, and then maybe I'll come back in and talk a little bit about how it's disrupting the education system, and then toss it back to Jack to talk a little bit about how this is disrupting the leadership management system from his perspective as well. And if that's okay, what I'll do is just talk a little bit about the three fallacies or the three thinking errors, the three barriers to clear thinking that we decided we would focus on, that you alluded to in the intro, Vern. And those are ad hominem attacks, and essentially ad hominem attacks are focusing on demeaning an individual so that you don't have to deal with what the individual is actually saying. The second barrier to clear thinking and civility that I thought we'd cover is straw man arguments. And basically, straw man arguments are misrepresenting what other people are saying and then attacking that misrepresentation so you don't have to deal with what the person is actually saying. And then the final one that I thought we'd cover today is false cause fallacy. And basically, false cause fallacy is the false belief that just because two things are happening in space or time, that one or the other is the cause of the other thing. So thought I'd just briefly introduce those barriers to clear thinking and civility, and then if it's okay with Marty, to pitch it over to him and have him talk a little bit about how those errors manifest themselves in the family system. Marty, is that okay with you?
Sounds great.
You know, this is interesting, particularly interesting to me, because over the weekend, Dr. Rand Paul made some comments about how much the government has spent on people that were injured by vaccines, and that is, people have run with that in terms of why it's saying that vaccines are dangerous and bad. And that's a whole conversation in and of itself. But I started a thread on that because I had people on two sides of the argument. And I wanted to see if it would relate to the others. And it was amazing how immediately both sets of people got engaged in either ad hominem attacks or other logical fallacies. So, and certainly a lack of civility, because as one person says right here off the top, any moron can search scientific papers aiming to confirm their stupid views. Now, it's kind of hard.
Thank you.
That's why I wanted to bring it in. This
hey,
guy,
not just any moron. Some of us don't have access to those.
Good point.
But
good point, Jack. Maybe you should post that underneath the post.
Any moron with a library card and a password, maybe.
Well, you know. To this end, I think it's one of the things, this is your show, but I think what's so important about this is in the technological age in which we live, and maybe we can include that as we go down the line, is the ability to be uncivil to one another is expanded based on our ability to not have to confront people face to face.
Yeah.
Mm.
And it builds on itself. Anyway, I had to throw that in because I think it ties in very well, because when you have those kinds of interactions going on, it's hard to have discourse, whether it be within your family, within your businesses, or your educational systems, that wind up very productively, or so it seems in my opinion.
And before I toss it on over to Marty in the family, I'm so glad that you jumped in, Vern, because that's a great example of, to me, what is the opposite of civility and civilization, and that is abuse. And so that might be something that we touch on in civility versus abuse in the family system, civility versus abuse in the education system, civility versus abuse in the leadership management system. So, with that, I'll just toss it on over to Marty and see where he wants to take us in terms of these themes in the family system.
So I have a marked advantage that I think I share with many, many of our listeners, which is that I have continuously been a member of a family for my entire life. So I have a rich treasure trove of both negative incidents and positive incidents in my life, many of which I have perpetrated on both sides. So I think the great thing about talking about family is that we all, basically most of us, and so we, it is so much a part of, it is the stuff of which we are made in our day-to-day lives. So so let me just briefly talk about a couple of things. The first of which is really a point I know Jack has championed in his work and which I think couldn't be overemphasized in the family, and that is the notion of civility, which I think is captured in the logical fallacy of ad hominem arguments. An ad hominem argument, as Brian said, is an argument where you attack the person making the argument instead of attacking the argument. In a family, what that does is degrade the relationships among members of the family. It degrades the person who's making the attack because he or she is viewed as somebody who's not safe and not fair and not honest and not sticking with the subject. It hurts the person being attacked because instead of working together to solve a difficult problem, now one person is being impugned or criticized by another person. And it also hurts the other members of the family who happen to spectate this event. So it's just as difficult to be the poor people in the car witnessing an ad hominem attack as it is to be the victim and the perpetrator of the attack. So everybody in a family loses when one member of the family engages in ad hominem arguments. So one thing we mentioned last show was we wanted to give super practical advice. So my super practical advice for when one member of a family is discussing a topic and it lapses over into attacking the person who had the other position or who took an argument. And I've seen this happen all the time in my own family as well as in other families. But one very practical suggestion I have for that is something that it just sounds so primitive, but it's so true. Number one, be nice. Be nice. Be especially nice to the people that you love, to the people that when you lock the door at night and put the nightlight on, are in there with you. Be especially nice to them. And the tricky part is we're so often the meanest and the harshest and engage in the most ad hominem attacking of the people we love the most. As my mother says, we only hurt the ones we love. And we need to stop that. We need to be nice. So that's my encapsulated thing with family and ad hominem. And I can tell you in true confessions, I have engaged in some variation of this so many times with my own family. And of course, I'm all the roles. I am a spouse. I am a father. I am a son. And so, and my parents are both still alive in their 90s, but still alive. And so lots of opportunities to get this wrong, but also lots of opportunities to get it right. My second practical message, besides just saying to yourself the mantra, be nice, just be nice, be nice to your people, is this. When you start to get upset with your family members, and we all do, they say things that just step on our last nerve, they upset us, they humiliate us, they infuriate us, they whatever, things build and build and build over days and weeks and months and years, you know, don't do the same argument we had 20 years ago kind of thing. So my second practical advice in that situation is, when you experience yourself starting to get upset, starting to use that primitive brain instead of the cortex, instead of being intentional, you're starting to get automatic and revved up and face red and heart beating faster and saying those negative things in your head in a do loop that you've said before. When that starts to happen, say, I need to take a 15-minute break. Everybody, I love everybody. I love my family. And so I'm going to spare you a rev up by me taking 15 minutes, and I'll be back in 15 minutes and I'll be a better me. So that's my thought about ad hominem and about two practical things that we can do to address those in the family. The second topic that we were going to talk about was false cause. So what I've noticed happens in families with false cause, in my own family in particular, but also as I overhear others, what we tend to do is take a single event, or we take something that has generally been correlated with something else, and say A caused B. So we'll say, every time you go to the after-school program, you come home 20 minutes late from dinner. So we need to stop the after-school program because we need to get you home on time for dinner. That's the kind of thing families say in conversations on a daily basis. But the truth is, that's a guess about what the cause of the lateness is for dinner. And so it's what we need to do is be much more careful to know that we really don't know what caused what in most cases. I committed this fallacy today. I was conversing with a colleague and I said, you know, I was just in Paris and it's clear that as an American, things were a little less friendly among the French with Americans than they had been before. And my colleague said, you know, that may not be actually the reason. You may have anticipated that was a cause and you put it in there, but you don't know that being American is what caused your experience with the French when you were recently there. And he was totally right. And so leading into practical things about how to avoid false cause conversations with family members, in other words, conversations with family members where we make a conclusion as if A caused B when we have inadequate evidence. One way to do that is to do just what my colleague did, which is to gently question whether for sure you know that's what caused it. And when you think about it, scientists spend their entire careers trying to figure out what causes what. So figuring out the cause of something is not a simple and quick bit of business. So one thing you can do is just gently point out to yourself and other people when in reality you don't have enough evidence to say this thing caused that thing. And then the second other very practical piece of advice besides holding yourself and other people accountable when you're hearing causal language is be humble. So remember with ad hominem attacks, the mantra for ourselves is be nice. Our mantra for false causes is be humble. And that includes intellectual humility. Know that we can't know everything and know that it's really hard to figure out what causes what. So instead of us making a decision about cause, let's be a little more tentative. Let's be humble. Okay, then the third thing, anybody want to jump in here? I've said a lot in a big run. Anybody?
I want to jump in. I want to ask you something. You hit two things that I think are worth pointing out, Marty. And one has to do with family. There's no more fundamental unit than family. That's why we both know what pushes each other's buttons the most. But it also seems to me that that's also one of the reasons where family is one of the best places to start honing our civility skills. If we can do it with family, we can probably take it out in the world. That's one thing. And I want to throw this in that hit me in what you just said in terms of the false cause things. There's this notion that it seems to permeate my life and others called it's just them, not me that does it. And your acknowledgement of your if you're catching yourself in the false cause. I was walking out of my house one day several months ago, heard something on a talk radio show that just ground me. And all of a sudden I says, wait a second, where did that come from? And was struck by the thought, what you react to, Vernon, runs you. So I thought that's very profound, because I think it's real easy to see that it's them out there that are reacting, them out there that do the false cause, them out there that are engaged in ad hominem attacks and let ourselves off the hook. So maybe you might want to comment on those two. The power of family is a place to cultivate our skills and civility, and ourselves being every bit as human as those we accuse outside of ourselves as being human.
I think you're absolutely right. It's familiarity, I think, is what leads us to a lack of familiarity often leads us to be more cautious and careful with people out in the world who are not our family members. And I think, sadly, sometimes familiarity leads us to be more comfortable to engage in behaviors with our family members that are more negative than we might feel comfortable doing with others. So that's not universally true, but I do think that's a piece of it. And Vern, you're right. One of the essences of humility is the point you just sort of made, which is you've got to own that I engage in these false cause. And we're going to talk about another one next, straw man and ad hominem attack. It's not just other people who have these logical fallacies or thinking errors. I have them. In fact, I have them sometimes so automatically that I don't even realize I'm doing them. So, yes, you're absolutely right. It has to start there. And I do agree with you with this notion that the thing that revs you up, the thing that takes you out of your centeredness, kind of owns you, because then you stop being intentional and careful and thoughtful, and you become sort of reactive. So, yeah, good point. Are people ready for me to jump over to straw man?
Sure, yeah, sure.
So in the family, sometimes what happens, at least in my experience, is when a family discussion or a conversation between two people gets heated, sometimes we flip over from wanting to come to an agreement or wanting to find the truth to wanting to win. And so the place where I see the straw man argument pulled out most frequently is when or one of us in the conversation has switched over to where the primary goal is now simply to win, to beat the other person in the debate. And straw man is a logical fallacy in which we shift away from the issue and create a sort of a false issue, a fake issue, a much easier issue to debate and discredit. And we pretend that that is what the person we're talking with had made as the original point. So when I think about the straw man fallacy, what I first think about is that there's been a motive switch in the conversation. If the conversation originally started out of let's understand one another, let's understand each other's positions, let's come to an agreement about a difficult issue, or let's make a decision as a family, and then somebody's ego gets activated, or maybe everyone's egos get activated, those are the times when people tend to resort to this really disingenuous discussion approach, which is straw man, that you make up a position the other person never had, and then you argue much more cogently against the position that you made up than you could have argued against the position that the person was actually taking. The two bad things about that in the family are it puts words in the mouth of a family member that they never said, which is also deeply, deeply disrespectful. And it causes more distance in a relationship, in a family relationship, where you want to have closeness, not more distance. And then the second thing is it's intellectually dishonest. So it is actually a form of deceit or dishonesty within your own family. And so as hard as it is, one of the bedrock principles, as we've already said about families, is we need to love one another. But another bedrock principle is we need to be honest with each other. And so the straw man argument basically violates both of those core principles. It's a tactic that sits on top of wanting to win over wanting to be kind or wanting to find the truth or reach a good solution. So, and having said that, I have definitely done this. You know, I want to win the argument, and so I make up an easier thing, and I, you know, very compellingly argue against that, and the other person's going, what? I didn't say that. And it doesn't work out well. So one of the very practical take-home message on this for families in my perspective is stay focused on the real issues. And part of that means talking back with your family member. What I heard you say, John, or what I heard you say, Mom, was blah, blah, blah. Do I have that right? Yes. Okay, good. So my thought about that is this. So checking in is one of the most straightforward, practical things you can do to not engage in straw man arguing, because if you've mischaracterized the other person's perspective and then give your family member an opportunity to say, no, that really wasn't what I was saying. That's not really my point at all. Then you can repeat what you think they said now clarified and get it right. So that's number one. And then number two is something that I also believe for both straw man and ad hominem, which is be hard on the problem or the issue, but be soft on the people. And the reason that's relevant for straw man, it's obvious why it's relevant for ad hominem, because ad hominem is deliberately being hard on the people, and it's and not on the issue or the problem. So that's obvious. But on straw man, you're being hard on the person by mischaracterizing the person's position, and that's not fair. So returning again, a very useful mantra for this logical fallacy in a family is be hard on the problem, be soft on the family member with whom you're discussing the problem.
And Marty, I thought I'd jump in really quickly because, oh, I'm sorry, Vern, if I could just say something really quickly. I'm not sure if John Spence is going to be able to join us today, so I'm going to try to bring in some of John's work in our discussion. But just wanted to point out so much of what Marty was talking about correlates with one of the sections of John's most recent books. I think it is his most recent book, which is Awesomely Simple. In the third section, he discusses robust communication. And I think so much of what Marty was speaking about in the family relates to what John has written about in the leadership management system, and that is if you play these games, if you use these fallacies, that you can actually harm the communication within the family and set up a situation where people will be less likely to feel safe to robustly communicate when they get out there in the work world. So I just wanted to throw that out there to represent some of John's work.
Yeah, good. I want to jump in one other thing, which is for people that are listening, if you would like to read another version of each of these logical fallacies, there's a wonderful website that Brian exposed me 2 years ago, and it's called yourlogicalfallacies.com. And it goes through a number of logical fallacies in a clear, straightforward way. And I think listeners would find that website really helpful.
And I imagine, Vern, we could put that website underneath the episode wherever we post it.
Yeah, what we'll have to do is we'll have to rework that. Wherever we post it, we can do whatever text we have. I'm limited in the show description as it shows up on the Blog Talk Radio site, but when we repost it elsewhere, we certainly will. So a quick question for both of you that are in the realm of psychology. Do you believe that ad hominem attacks as well as straw man logical fallacies are always deliberate, or do you think they occur sometimes because the person is not aware of it? they're committing that fallacy. I know that Dr. Higley here is very focused on logical fallacies and people seeing them, but is it possible to misrepresent someone else's argument unintentionally? You didn't think that you were.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I can jump in real quick, Marty, if it's all right with you, and say a few words and then bounce it back to you. And then, Jack, if you've got anything to add, we'd love to hear it as well. But
is that dismissive, one of the things, Brian, that comes to mind, Jack, if you have anything to add?
I'm sorry? Oh, yeah.
I'm just teasing. I'm saying, is that dismissive,
I've got some strong
Brian?
Opinions on this, but I want to hear what you guys say first and see.
Yeah. So for me, one of the things that comes to mind now, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, or maybe one of my listeners or our listeners will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this quote was attributed to Socrates, and it comes to my mind a lot when I speak about fallacies and how they're connected to civility versus abuse. And I think the notion is that no one does evil except by ignorance. And so what I have found is maybe two levels of quote-unquote ignorance. One is they just don't know what these fallacies are. And one of the reasons why, actually, Jack touched base last episode on one of the notions that I think is so important, and that is if you've got an individual versus a system, the system is probably going to win every time. That was one of the quotes that Jack brought up. And I think so often, and one of the reasons why I do this podcast and I do this work is because of this, is that if you have people that go through a family system, an education system, and a leadership management system that does not bring awareness of these fallacies to them, I think it's fair to assume that they're just unaware or ignorant of the actual fallacy. So they'll go about doing these things without actually knowing them. The second level of quote-unquote ignorance in my mind is that even if you know the fallacies, that you might have a sort of empathic ignorance, so to speak, where you don't yet understand how negatively impactful this stuff is to yourself, to your family members, to, if you're in education, your fellow students, and to the culture as a whole. So you might have intellectual awareness of this, but because of some kind of barrier to emotional empathy, you are quote-unquote ignorant of how damaging these things are. So those are the two things that I typically talk about when people ask me, and they ask me a lot. Do you think people are abusing and harming themselves and others consciously or unconsciously? That's my current answer, at least.
So Vernon, I had a couple of thoughts as well, and then I definitely want to hear what Jack has to say. The first one is to answer it straightforwardly. Absolutely, people, in fact, myself included, have engaged in these behaviors sometimes repeatedly without realizing what we're doing. So closely related to that is the idea of habit. So sometimes what happens is we get in a habit of responding when we have a certain affective state or a certain response or a certain set level of arousal. And if that habit happens to be straw man or that habit happens to be ad hominem attack, we build a strong pattern or a strong tendency to engage in just those behaviors in just those circumstances over and over and over. And I think sometimes it becomes so routinized we aren't even aware that that's what's happening. So that's part number one. And part number two goes to something Brian said, which is hurt people hurt people. So when people have hurt feelings or their pride is hurt or they feel embarrassed or they feel humiliated, those are the times when we're most likely to engage in hurtful behaviors. And straw men and ad hominem are, I think, classic cases of that.
Jack, where does this occur in business?
Well, before I say where it occurs in business, let me try to answer your question. Do I believe that these logical fallacies are always deliberate? And it's going to be hard for me to answer it without demonstrating what I think is the main cause. And what I mean by that is I truly believe that one of the biggest reasons for logical fallacies, whether they're in a family, whether they're in business, is the fact that most of us do not like to think any more than we can get away with. The whole idea of system one versus system two thinking. Thinking is hard work, and it's so easy to do, as Marty said, to respond by habit. it's a lot harder to sit back and rein in your responses and actually be curious about the other person and try to figure out why they think that way and try to come up with counter explanations before you immediately ascribe an intention to them. And by the way,
Jack, I have to interrupt here. I have to interrupt here because you just threw something out there that I think that you really need to take a little bit of time to flesh out for the audience. Sorry there, I'm the host. And that is you need to flesh in system one and system two thinking a little bit. You threw that out there. I'm acquainted with what you. I've been exposed to what you're saying. I think we'll find out when you hear what you're saying.
You're absolutely right.
But I'm
guilty of the curse of knowledge. I know what it means, and I believe everybody on this call knows what it means, but perhaps our listeners don't. And Marty or Brian, please jump in to correct my explanation here. System two thinking is the slow, complex, rational type of thought that we all think of as thinking. We actually don't do very much of that. I don't know what the number is, but an extremely high percentage of what's going on in our mind is system one thinking. It's intuitive, it's fast, it's frequently right, but it's also frequently wrong. And it's very habitual. And system one thinking is almost autopilot. We kind of system one thinking, we react without really thinking things through. System two requires a lot of work because it takes a lot of, quite frankly, of physical calories to engage our brain into thinking. And I think that the term popularized by Daniel Kahneman, and basically Daniel Kahneman said that whenever we're confronted with a serious or a difficult problem, we try to solve an easier problem. So what I mean by that is if somebody comes up to me and explains to me how this device that I've never seen before works and tells me why this is the best thing for me, say a salesperson, I don't know enough to know whether to be able to judge that person's claims. So what I do is I rely on the intuitive things such as, does this person sound trustworthy? Are they dressed appropriately? Do they look honest? And so on. So I'm making decisions. But then, of course, when I go to my boss and say, and he says, why did you agree to spend $50,000 on this? I'm not going to tell him, well, it's because I like the way the guy came across. I'm going to rationalize what my thinking was, even though my decision was probably already made at a more system one level. Does that make sense?
And that particular thing is called a system one hijack. In other words, system one has hijacked system two to justify the decision that was made intuitively or automatically.
Correct. And then system two goes to dress it up for public consumption, but it probably wasn't the reason that we did it in the first place. And by the way, I just want to throw in kind of a little bit of color to your point, Brian, about Socrates said about no one does evil except by ignorance. There's a little more modern version of that. It's called Hanlon's Razor, if you've heard of that. And Hanlon's Razor says, never attribute to malice that which is adequately explained by stupidity. and I think that is extremely powerful. When somebody says something that I don't like, it's the system one hijack is going to say that person must have malice because if I don't like it, the way it reacted on me is the way that I'm going to take it. But maybe it was just ignorance, and it's probably a little safer to at least start with ignorance, and then if you think it through and you question a person and then you decide that it was malice, at least you got to it after a little bit of discussion.
You know, Jack, that reminds me a little bit of some John Stuart Mill. Three reasons why it's important to listen to dissent. Have you come across this yet, Jack?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you might like this. Okay, I think this is from On Liberty, and if I'm wrong, someone will correct me. But the first is, okay, so you can encounter something that you think is ignorant or stupid or whatever. The first reason to listen is that you might be ignorant or stupid, and they can disabuse you of that issue. The second is that you might have almost everything right, but they might give you just a little tweak so you're even more right.
Right.
And then the third reason is, even if they're completely wrong, which I think John Stuart Mill essentially thought is almost impossible or extremely rare, but let's say you're completely right and they're completely wrong, you at least get practice arguing against ignorance. So he was really big on taking much of what you just talked about, I think, even to another level of positive regard for other people. And that is, boy, you never really know who is the ignorant one. So listen carefully. Yeah.
The only thing I would add to Mill is I think that there's a fourth reason, is that you might actually, if you are right, if you are totally right, that you might help that other person, you might convert them or enlighten them. But he probably didn't put that there because that's so rare.
Mm-hmm. Mm, I like that. Yeah.
So I wanted to add in a couple quick pieces here. Jack, you get an A+. You spoke beautifully about System 1 and System 2.
Thank you.
And you mentioned Daniel Kahneman. He wrote a really readable book just a few years ago called Thinking Fast and Slow. And so our readers who want to know more about this, it's one of those nightstand reads, hit it 30 minutes a night in a few days. You've really learned something. So it's in paperback. It's affordable. Great book on exactly these topics that Jack is talking about. This idea actually goes all the way back to the very beginning of psychology, and it goes back to William James, who said that there was an associative thinking system and a true reasoning system, which bears a striking similarity to what we're talking about. As Jack pointed out, this system one is associative. It's what's associated with what I can quickly come to it, boom. And then the true reasoning one is the one Jack talks about as system two, which is the idea that you have to grind, you burn calories, you've got to, you know, that notion of smoke coming out of your ears as you're trying to think things through. And to link that back to what we talked about earlier, it is when we sit in that system one or that associative system thinking, that quick and dirty thinking system, when we're prone to engage in logical fallacies, including false cause, including straw man, including ad hominem. And so part of why I think it's so important when you get upset, take a 15-minute break, is when you get upset, you're not using the part of your brain that is going to engage effortfully in careful thought. You're not going to be engaging in system one brain when you're riled up. You reduce your capacity to do that when you're overly aroused. And so that 15 minutes allows your brain chemistry to settle back down and gives you an opportunity to engage your family members or whomever you're dealing with in a way that is rational and logical and less harmful than before.
Yep.
You know, I want to jump in here real quick. I've come to, you know, Kahneman's book is great. And for those that are too lazy to or don't want to buy it or whatever, I don't want to be disparaging. he also has done some talks on YouTube to the Google staff and a variety of people so people can get the flavor. I've come to think of system one thinking is what I'd call reflexive thought versus thinking. They're the thoughts that reflexively just pop into, you know, they just pop into your mind. And there's a great piece, I don't know if you guys have seen it, in the New Yorker from 2012 that says why smart people are stupid. And what's powerful about that one to me is it really gets to the heart of what I think can be a real problem in our day and age, is that quite frequently people mistake the fact for being intelligent or having a lot of knowledge. They think it insulates them from this reflexive thought that's as reflexive as hitting your knee with a doctor's reflex hammer.
Uh-huh.
I just need to throw that out there because most of what's called thinking, I don't think is personally, but that's just an opinion, and you can do with that what you want. So
I would agree with you, Vern, and I want to piggyback off that. It's coincidental. Just last week in the New York Times Book Review, it was the Economist Book Review. They reviewed a book that was almost the exact same title as you just said, Why Smart People Are Stupid or Do Stupid Things. Unfortunately, the book just came out in England and is not available in the U.S. till August. So I haven't read it yet. But what the review said was that smart people, A, are just as prone to logical fallacies as anybody else.
Exactly.
But what makes it worse for smart people is that then they are so good at coming up with rationalizations why they are right rather than figuring out why they might be wrong.
Mm-hmm. So that's a nice segue, Jack. I don't know if we want to go here, Jack and everybody, but that's a perfect segue into how this impacts the education system. Are
good.
You guys ready to move from the family?
I want to do a quick little blurb in there, which is to say, okay. That is that fact that Jack just pointed out and that Vern initiated is the difference between intellectual humility and system one hijack. So intellectual humility says, let me stop and rethink this and make sure I'm not going down a bad path. And system two hijack says, system one hijack is it says, let me use all my cleverness to buttress the point that I came to so quickly. Mm-hmm. And those are sort of choices we have. So anyway, with that, yes, I think you're right. Let's move to the education system.
Yeah, and Marty, I just want to say one other thing on that, if you just indulge me, is I think that for me is the closest thing to an antidote for reflexive thought, given the fact that I can't avoid that, but I can always reassess the thoughts that continually come up reflexively. And although I'm subject to the same errors, it gives me a chance to rethink things and, as you put it, exercise humility along the way and admit my mistakes, rethink things, interact with people, etc.
True.
Okay, so I thought that was when Jack said that, I thought now it is time to talk education system. So glad you guys are ready to journey into that area with me. Before I do that, I do want to again bring some of John Spence's work into this, back to a comment on System 1 versus System 2 thinking, how they both of those ways of thinking can be connected to civility and or abuse. The first section in John's book, Awesomely Simple, discusses vivid vision. And what we've actually found in the science is that normally people are cognitive misers, which is that you don't want to spend a lot of energy thinking about things that you don't have to think about, except if doing something, including thinking hard, is aligned with something that really matters to them. And so one of the things that I think is really important, both for this podcast, you know, I talk about it whenever I'm consulting, whenever I'm educating, is I try to get across in a vivid vision way what the cost of these different ways of thinking are and what the cost is of more valid thinking. And so we're moving from family to education, so I do want to talk a little bit about family before we transition. The cost of allowing these fallacies into our families, I think Marty outlined them so well, is essentially that you're psychologically, and in some cases this leads to physically, abusing the people that you love. And so what I'd like to get across to people is, yes, this takes a little more time. Yes, this takes a little more energy. But it is essential to having a loving, connected home. And if you don't do it, the cost can be massive in terms of physical and psychological abuse. And I do want to mention somebody in Gainesville, Florida, a colleague of Marty and mine, Dr. Paul Wheeler, who has done a lot of work in that community, and I think nationally as well, raising awareness of how minimization, denial, blame, and distortion is at the root of domestic violence. And minimization, denial, blame, and distortion, I think, is are four different ways to talk about all the different things that happen when you do engage in logical fallacies. So just wanted to make mention about how, yes, it can be difficult to do this stuff, and sometimes people do avoid difficult things. But I think, as John's book clearly describes, if there's a vivid vision behind what it is that you're planning to do, you're more likely to do it, even if it takes more time and energy. Any thoughts on that before we move on to education?
As you were chatting about it, one of the things that really crossed my mind was, especially if your family has young children in it, your young children, if you're the parents or the grandparents, or some other older family member, an older sibling, for example, those children are watching you, and they are likely to emulate your behavior. So if your behavior is illogical, harmful, dishonest, then it makes it more likely that you're going to pass that on to the next generation. And that's something we don't really want to pass on to the next generation. So there's the special burden for older members of the family when there are children in the family to really avoid those behaviors.
Jack, Vern, any thoughts before we transition to the second system?
No, I think what Marty said is very, very powerful, and I think that's one of the things that's important to note is how important old people like me can be in a society. My granddaughters adore me. I've taught them right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I guess the only thing that I would add to what Marty said is that that applies everywhere. It's not just in the family. It's not just children watching you. If you're a CEO, people are watching you.
And that, Jack, is exactly why I want us to journey into excellence across all three of these systems. Perfectly said. That this matters in the family.
And if you're in education.
And it matters in leadership. Yep. Okay, so education. I thought what I would do is, Marty sort of went fallacy by fallacy with some suggestions, which I thought was great. I think what I'll do is I'll go through all three of the fallacies and then make some specific suggestions at the end of that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to set up some scenarios that I have personally observed and that I've seen in the literature, and I'm going to talk about educator to student. But you could replace educator and student with student and educator. You could also replace this with administrator to educator. So all of these different scenarios I've seen or read about in all kinds of situations. But I'm just going to talk about it as educator to student. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So false cause. I thought what I'd talk about in terms of false cause is something that I've heard a lot of educators discussing. It's a pretty hot topic, I think, nationally in terms of education. I myself have struggled with it as well. So the scenario is this, and again, you can replace educator with student administrator if you want to. But in class, an educator confronts an idea. Let's say, for example, a claim without evidence. I'm a science instructor, and so I'm really big on making sure that when somebody claims something that they have some sort of valid evidence to support it. So let's say an educator confronts an idea, a claim without evidence, for example, or a behavior, maybe turning in work past deadline, and a student gets upset and reports that educator to an administrator. The administrator then concludes that the educator caused the upset rather than the student's difficulty with being confronted in a reasonable way. So that's an example of false cause. And again, I've seen it happen educator to student. I've seen it happen student to educator, administrator, and back. But that's just an example that instead of saying, okay, something good has happened here, something they conclude something bad has happened because they are caught up in a false cause. The next step that can happen is where straw man can come into play. Straw man, as Marty said, is misrepresenting what someone actually said in order to make in order to attack something that actually didn't get said or actually happening. So while reporting being upset with the educator in this scenario, Instead of the student saying, well, I got upset because the educator confronted me about making a claim without evidence, the student actually misrepresents what happened. So instead of saying, well, I was confronted in a reasonable way, the student can say, the educator doesn't care about me, or the educator said, shut up, or the educator laughed at me. So that's where straw man can come into play in the education system. And then the next step that I've seen and read about happening then brings in ad hominem attacks. So in this scenario, and again, I do want to stress that I've seen it educator to student, student to educator, administrator to educator. I don't want to put just students in the bad place here. But instead of staying focused on whether or not the confrontation made sense or was reasonable, the educator gets attacked in an ad hominem way. So not that I disagree with being confronted about making claims without evidence. There might be claims like the educator's a jerk, the educator is evil, the educator is really, really unqualified to do what it is that they're supposed to do. So that's one scenario where false cause, straw man, and ad hominem can build on each other. And what happens is that an educator, a student, or an administrator that's doing something reasonable, which is confronting somebody by saying, hey, if you've got a claim, you've got to back that up with evidence, it moves very quickly from something that I think we want to do as educators into this horror show where educators, students, and or administrators are forced to defend themselves against ad hominem attacks and straw man arguments. And so before I go into any sort of specific methods of taking care of this, I thought I'd stop and see if anybody has anything they want to say about this scenario.
Go ahead, Doc.
You guys good?
Sure. Yep.
Go ahead.
Good.
Okay. So does this scenario make sense to you as something problematic and something that could break down the excellence in an education system? Do I need to describe that a little bit more?
No, although I think you're absolutely right. And my guess is, although I'm not sure, that these kind of things that you were just mentioning are occurring more frequently with the shift in our educational culture over the last 25 years, I'd say, to sort of make sure that people always have a good affective or emotional experience in their educational process rather than emphasizing the fundamental aspects of learning, which are permanent change in behavior, that may or may not be difficult and challenging.
Yes, and that would bring in something, and maybe this will be something we could cover in an upcoming episode, and that is the logical fallacy appeal to emotion.
Yep.
So instead
yep.
of appealing to, does this make sense, is, for example, challenging people in education to back up their claims with evidence, is it reasonable, even if it's upsetting to certain people? So we might want to flag and that
goes back
and revisit that later.
I agree, and it ties back to a point that Jack made earlier, which is that that when you have to work hard to think things through, which is what education very, very frequently requires, it's sometimes painful, it's challenging, it's difficult, it's exhausting. And so sometimes the emotions that are triggered by us engaging in real learning are not necessarily positive ones.
And I thought, Marty, I'd piggyback on that. And some of the literature that I've seen and then some of the personal talks I've had with educators, and it's heartbreaking as somebody who loves education and sees it as what we're talking about in this series as essential to a high-functioning civilization, is I've talked with and I've seen people talk as well and write about this, that there are certain educators who will not do what it is that they think is best for students because, for a variety of different reasons, they fear punishment, which is a huge issue that we need to look into if it is as widespread as it seems to be, at least to me. When you think about the highest quality educators not doing high quality education because of the possibility of the system punishing the highest quality education.
Do you all remember the series
Brian,
of Dune?
Brian, to this end, I want Marty to, if he could or would, to add to this, is where he sees the role of family in the education system with respect and with regard to working with the education system so that the students get the best, the teachers get the best, all that. Because I think there's huge tie-ins there that are frequently not understood and or misunderstood, including what the whole purpose of education may be.
Yep, that sounds good. I'll quickly do that because I think we've got a limited amount of time. So before I do that, I quickly wanted to mention there was a series of Doonesbury comics. Remember the famous comic series Doonesbury in the Sunday papers? A number of years ago, there were a series, maybe a dozen of them, that were about exactly the issue that Brian is talking about. So there is this fictitious professor at a fictitious university engaging with his students. And time after time after time, they are demanding that he demands less and less and less from them. And he sort of caves in panel after panel, week after week. He caves in on this, apparently because the university won't support him actually demanding that the students learn what they're supposed to learn the way they're supposed to learn it. But to go back to Vern's question, I do think if the family signals that education is important and that it's hard work, and that the people who are in the business of education are to be respected for their craft and so forth, you get a different outcome than if the family has decided that the goal is for their child to always make an A, and that if anything falls short of that, it's probably the fault of the instructor. And of course, the truth, there's no simple truth in this, but I do think over the, as I said last, probably 2.5 decades, there's been a kind of a shift so that all have won and all must have prizes often replaces the student will receive the grade the student has earned. And that those two different perspectives are fundamentally different and incompatible. And I think that may tie to a lot of what Brian was just talking about.
And I think to piggyback onto that and how it relates both to the family system and what Jack's going to talk about here soon, how it relates to the leadership and management system, is I think when you analyze this, you start to realize, oh my gosh, if what we're talking about in here is happening at any sort of level, what we actually have is a huge system that impacts tons and tons of people that punishes clear thinking and civility and rewards poorer thinking and a lack of civility. So this is a really big deal. And one of the things that I thought that I would do is talk a little bit about what people can do in very specific ways to help in this regard. Does that sound like a good place to go now? I want to leave some time for Jack to investigate the leadership management system.
Absolutely. Yep. Good.
Good. Okay, so Marty knows this. I think I might have sent some of this to you, Vern, and you, Jack, over the years. I'm not sure. But one of the things that I've been doing is looking into what are the factors that differentiate between what people wish they would do and people actually doing more of what they wish they would do. So wishing versus doing. And what I've come up with are 5 different factors, and Marty's been working with me on these factors to in the education system to educate more and more students to be to have more self-efficacy across these factors so that they can change in ways that they wish to change. And the acronym is that sort of summarizes this literature is STEAM, S-T-E-A-M. And one of the ways we like to talk about it is that STEAM is a form of H2O, help to ourselves and others. So all of my recommendations are going to be centered around STEAM. The essence theme is social support. So one of my recommendations, if you want to decrease false cause, if you want to decrease straw man, you want to decrease ad hominem attack, recruit people around you who are really committed to improving clear thinking and through clear thinking civility. And one of the reasons why I'm so happy to be on these podcasts with you all is that I consider you all part of my social support system. Of people who do take clear thinking and civility really, really seriously. And once we get these podcasts out, that we can serve as social support to other people who may not be able to find the Jack Malcolms, the Vernon Boers, or the Marty Haysackers of the world themselves, so that we might be able to serve as social support. So find people who really care about this stuff and hang out with them a lot. If you can't find them, then look up podcasts like this and sort of hang out with us in a technological way. So that's the S in STEAM. The T in STEAM is time perception. We're more likely to do what we wish to do if we perceive to have enough time for it. So one of the simple things that I usually recommend to people is set aside time during the day, or if you don't have a daily enough time daily, then set aside for a week. If you don't have something every week, then at least every month, to actually study these fallacies and think about them. And I think the website that Marty mentioned earlier, yourlogicalfallacyis.com, is one way in which to sort of sit down and study this stuff on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis. So that's the T in STEAM, time perception. Enjoyment is the E in STEAM.
Can I quickly jump in on time perception?
Oh, yeah, go. Yes.
Yeah. So the operative word there is perception. We all have 168 hours a week allotted to us, not a minute more, not a minute less for any single person. But what happens to us is we use our time in ways that, if we really took a cold, hard look at it, don't really match necessarily our vision or our mission or our big objectives. And then we are left with an inadequate amount of time to do the things that we say really do reflect our important things. And so therefore we have the perception of time, of inadequate time, when the reality is we acted in ways that gave the time to things that we say are less important.
And that's one of the things that Marty and I both work really hard on. We give all of our students what we call a STEAM training manual. And one of the exercises in the STEAM training manual is to outline what people's objectives are and then to do an analysis of where they spend their time on a weekly basis. And that might be something we get into a little bit more in depth as we continue our journey.
Right.
Didn't this come up in the last show too, so that the listening audience knows that was it John that said, or one of you that always has people fill out a questionnaire regarding what are the goals? I thought it was John.
That's talking about values.
Yep. Yes. I think I piggybacked on that and told him about the objectives that I have people fill out. And Marty does the same thing through the STEAM training manual in his classes as well.
I'm just testing my own memory here because it seems like a recurring theme in terms of time, you know, perception and time.
And if you want to build
speaking
on
of
that,
time,
go ahead.
Well, speaking of time, I don't want to over-talk anybody, but I do want to give Jack enough time to speak about the leadership system. So I'm going to go real quickly through the rest of the STEAM stuff and then just pitch it to Jack if that's okay. The E in STEAM is enjoyment. There's a great book by a psychologist called Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. I won't try to spell it for you, but the book is called Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience. And what he actually found is that you enjoy things more if you match your skills to your challenges. And so one of the ways that people who want to get better at avoiding these fallacies can enjoy this is if you find that you're getting overwhelmed by all the fallacies that are out there, just focus on one per day or one per week or one per month. Don't overload yourself so that you don't enjoy the process. Do it at a pace that helps you to enjoy it. The A in STEAM is accessibility. We do more of what we wish to do if we have access to the information that we need in order to do it. And this gets back to the sort of websites that Marty spoke about and some of the books that we've been talking about. Just keep this stuff really accessible. I have yourlogicalfallacyis.com on my computer all the time. I bring it up all the time. It's always easily accessible so that I can study it and think about it on a regular basis. And then the M in STEAM is motivation, and this gets back to some of John Spence's work that relates to a lot of intrinsic motivation science, and that is connect what you're doing with something that really matters to you. And this goes back to the first section in John's book on vivid vision. One of the reasons why I have lots of STEAM, lots of motivation to keep talking about these things, bringing them up, thinking about them, do podcasts about them, is because doing so is connected to a vision that really matters to me. And that is, I believe that people who liberate themselves from these fallacies promote life, liberty, happiness pursuit, and people who do not liberate themselves from these thinking fallacies promote abuse. And so that's a scheme-centered sort of analysis of some pretty simple, straightforward things that, people can do if they want to start eradicating some of these fallacies out of their lives and the lives of the people around them. And with that, I'll toss it on over to Jack and see if he's got anything to say about what we've just said, or if he wants to just sort of move on and talk a little bit about how these fallacies can degrade the leadership management system.
Well, let me focus on how they apply to leadership and management. And I'm going to throw this out more as a hypothesis than an assertion on my point, because I don't have enough evidence. But I think that business, as opposed to the family and education, has at least got some self-correction mechanisms built into it, to where if these logical fallacies remain unchecked, businesses are going to fail or they're going to lose money. So the discipline of the marketplace is maybe going to help correct some of these, the simplistic thinking. And to me, it's not just these three fallacies. It's the whole idea that I talked about just overly simplistic, where people are not putting the depth of thought into something and trying to figure out exactly what the root causes are of the problem that they're trying to solve, being able to know what is the end goal going to look like, and not just immediately, but over certain specified periods of time, who else is going to be affected, and so on. So from that aspect of it, I believe that, yes, the fallacies are still just as common out there, but there's probably more mechanisms built in to at least make sure they don't get out of control. And I'd throw that out and just see what you guys think about that.
True.
Yep. I where I thought you were going to go with that, Jack, was with a family fraught with fallacies, and then an educational system that the children are passed to that can be fraught with fallacies and fails to challenge fallacious thinking in the students, then they're hired into businesses and corporations that then struggle because the employees don't have the tools and the skills.
Correct.
So speak about that if you don't mind.
Because as you were saying earlier, Brian, that the educators are worried about asking for the best out of somebody because they may get punished for it. In business, you get rewarded for pushing people to give you their best. And if they don't like it, if they get upset, yeah, they can go to human resources. But in most cases, the manager is going to win that battle. So
now here's something. Oh, go ahead, Jack. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No. So from that aspect of it, I believe business is a lot more real life, and things that you can get away with. You might be able to skate through 4 years of college, getting away with these things. But at some point, you're going to run into a brick wall called reality, and you're going to have to compete against other people who are just as smart as you are, but maybe have learned how to think a little bit more carefully about things.
This reminds me of discussions, emails, and dinners that I've had with John Spence for going on 2 decades now, and I'm thinking again about his awesomely simple book. And maybe I'll throw this out here as something that might contest that hypothesis, and we'll see where it takes us.
Mm-hmm.
He and I have been discussing, you know, his awesomely simple book is, I think, well aligned with the literature on organizational excellence and individual excellence. And one of the things that we've been talking about over the years is how relatively few businesses follow these awesomely simple sort of concepts. And I'll just put them out there for the listeners.
Right.
The section one is vivid vision. Section two is best people. And I think that gets to the heart of a little bit of what you've been talking about, Jack, is that when you get out there hypothetically in the quote-unquote real world, you better be one of the best people or the system will spit you out. But I want to get back to that hypothesis because I don't know if that's reality. Section 3 in John's book, Robust Communication. Section 4, Sense of Urgency. Section 5, Disciplined Execution. And Section 6, Extreme Customer Focus. And so I'll try to represent what he and I have been discussing over the decades as well as I can. Maybe John will correct me at some other point if I'm off base. But we've been throwing around hypotheses about maybe the opposite hypothesis, Jack, of what you put out there, and that is, if these are awesomely simple, and if they are connected to what actually works, why is it that so few companies, rather than maybe so many companies, if your hypothesis is correct, we would see lots of companies doing this, I think. Why is it that so few companies are actually doing these awesomely simple things? Any thoughts on that?
Well, that's like asking why did Aristotle wrote some great books, sort of the ones that survive, on ethics and living a good life that I don't think anybody's really improved on, but for 2,500 years, why do people still insist on living not up to that?
I love it. Yes, same question.
Yeah.
Which I think is a counter-hypothesis, perhaps, to, unless I'm misreading your hypothesis.
It is. But what I'm saying is that just because business doesn't do it perfectly doesn't mean that at least there aren't some mechanisms in there that at some point, if you violate enough of John's six points, you're going to go out of business. And the thing is, in business, nobody ever does anything perfectly, and if they do, it's only for a fleeting moment, because then somebody else is going to figure out a better way to do it at some point. So sometimes businesses just don't do enough stupid stuff so that you continue to survive.
And maybe life is that as well. Yeah. So I would replace, from my perspective, perfectly, because I don't think perfectly exists with at a high level, you know, and I think if I'm hearing you right, you're saying, well, maybe it's not happening at a high level in any of these systems, but business may be differently than some of these other systems have a way in which to at least punish the really low functioning.
That would be correct.
Okay.
And part of this goes to, and this is probably a discussion for another time, but my whole idea of lean communication, the whole process of lean thinking, is fascinating to me, because the more I think about it, the more you see waste everywhere in society, in business, and in life. And waste is defined as anything that does not contribute to value. Mm. And there is waste everywhere. So you could take any one of John's six, and who knows if even those six are A, the right ones, or B, are sufficient, but you could take any one of those, and any one of us could measure ourselves against those and realize there's more that can be done.
Yeah.
Yep.
But, yeah, that makes sense.
And in some ways, some days I get discouraged and say, man, there is so much waste. It's a never-ending battle. But most of the time I get excited and say, there are so many more ways to find, to squeeze more value out of things, to get better, to change things for the better. And I want to throw in a couple of pieces of advice related to these specific logical fallacies. There is one, and I'm not sure, somebody probably came up with this phraseology. I think that I did, but I'm sure I probably got it from somewhere else. And I call it the forgotten diagonals. And what I mean by that is that when you go to the false cause fallacy, basically that false cause fallacy says that if you do X, Y will happen. And when you're saying that implicitly, you're looking at only two diagonals of a four square box. And one is, if you do X, this will happen. If you don't do X, this will not happen. And most business books, I would say that is exactly what their message is, regardless of whatever X and Y are. Do it this way and you will succeed. Mm. Don't do it this way and you will fail. And I say, that's great, but let's take a look at those other two diagonals. Are there people who have not done this and have succeeded? And are there people who have done this and not succeeded? And what percentage of those, and look at those percentages. And I'm sure there's probably a term for what I'm talking about. It's not original to me, but you always have to question everything that somebody says, question it in those terms and say, are we looking at all four potential diagonals? And then I'm sorry?
Jack, the way that we talk about it in science, which you might already know, is that we manipulate the independent variable to see what happens to the dependent variable.
Right.
That's exactly what we talk about in research methods. Yep,
okay.
You nailed it.
Okay. And there's one other way, and I actually learned this in a book by Daniel Willingham, and it's called When Can You Trust the Experts? And he suggests what he calls strip it and flip it. So whenever somebody makes a claim, what you need to do is take that claim and write it down in this format. If I do X, there is a Y percent chance that Z will happen. So if somebody says, improve your communication and your business is going to do better, then I'm going to say, if I do X, and improving communication probably has to be a little more specific, if I do 1, 2, and 3, there is a what percent, X unknown percent or some percent chance that I will succeed, and how do I define that? And I think
Marty, do you want to say something about? Oh, I'm sorry, Jack.
If you take that and break it down and actually put it down on paper and try to fill out those blanks, you will then automatically be thinking much deeper than probably 90% of the people out there.
Marty, do you want to say something about how that maps onto variance and that sort of thing in the science realm? That's what I thought of when he was talking about that.
Yes, I will. But before I do that, when you first raised the question, how much should you trust the experts? My first answer is never. Never trust the experts. Trust the evidence that the experts developed and consumed in order to be labeled expert. But you don't. Yeah. So science is loaded with examples of scientific experts who had an opinion about something that was just completely false, myself included. So there's that. But the other thing is, I love this. I love the exercise that you. What did you say the author's name is? Daniel Willem?
Daniel Willingham.
Willingham. So I love that because
I wrote a blog post about it. I'll send you a link to it, and then it's got a link to the book.
Great. So what I love about that is that it causes people to engage in a much more logical, careful, even science-driven way. The point that Brian was actually getting to, I believe, is something that's sort of all in the background of what we're talking about, which is that what we as human beings tend to do is look for answers that says A leads to B. A always leads to B. A leads to nothing but B. A leads to B all the time. And the truth is, at least with regard to behavioral and social science, which is the area where Brian Higley and I spend our time, that is simply never true. What we're really doing is accounting for some proportion of the variance that's usually way less than 100% for each decision. So what we might do is have an answer of the form, it is 20% more likely that a business will succeed when this occurs than when this doesn't occur.
Right.
Or it's 5% more likely a business will fail when this is done rather than when this is not done. And so part of what we want to do is right-size people's expectations. If there were some very clean, simple, straightforward action that accounted for 100% of success or 100% of failure, I'm all ears. I'm ready for it, but I don't think.
Well, then I think everybody would do that.
Indeed. And then to get back to something earlier that you were talking about, Jack, with Brian, I think you laid out right at the outset the idea that business has a system, the market, that actually is very corrective of an organization that is dysfunctioning. So one of the things I wanted to add to that, because I do think in general that is true, it's not the only source of failure, but it certainly is a big source, is that, and you're the expert, I'm not, but something on the order of 50% of businesses fail. which means that there, if that statistic, if I'm quoting that accurately, it's a very high percent. It's not like 5 or 20%. Yeah. Am I right on that?
Well, I've heard similar statistics, but I think they mostly have to do with startup businesses. What percentage fail within the first X number of years?
Which actually goes to the same place. But my point is,
right.
My point is that if, as Brian said, fallacious thinking and, as you said, taking a cognitively miserly approach are both super common, then it shouldn't surprise us that a lot of startup businesses don't make it because the same people are populating them as are populating our schools that are often failing our students and are populating families where we need to do a little better job of working with our children.
Yep.
You guys got me on the edge of my seat here because this thing has just actually, you've just blown it wide open as far as I'm concerned. I started with a question for Jack, and that was, have you seen changes in the people coming into the business world out of the education system over the years? What are they? And are you seeing any of those changes that you consider could be potentially fatal in the long run to business beyond the scope of what we can talk about today? And when you talked about forgotten diagonals, I've come to see things like that as either or thinking, which eventually ties back into Brian's whole passion for your logical fallacy is website, of which one is black and white thinking.
Right.
And, you know, we can go as long as you guys want. We certainly could go another half hour if you want.
I've got to cut out here
into there,
quick.
But should we, let's kind of wrap it up. Everyone have a wrap up, say. We'll wrap up the show, and this will leave us in a good place for starting to put together and formulating the next show, I would think.
Good.
So, Brian,
start.
Do you want to? Okay, go.
I'm thinking let's give Brian the last word maybe.
Okay.
As we're wrapping up the show, one of the things that becomes really clear to me is that even though we're each coming from different places, and in fact, Jack focused on the business world and Brian on the education world and I focused on the family world, the core principles that we're discussing are really the same principles. So what we're not doing is inventing different principles to account for what's going on in each of these three spheres of human behavior. What we are doing is applying the same core principles to these three human spheres of human behavior, and they would apply to other spheres of human behavior as well.
Jack.
Yep. Well, I'm going to wrap it up by just giving you something that I think is interesting. It all goes to, if people know better, why do they not do it? And Vern, you mentioned that 2012 New Yorker article. I took the liberty of just pulling it up real quick while somebody was talking. And you know who wrote that?
You.
No, it was written by Jonah Lehrer. And I don't know if the name rings a bell with you, but as soon as I read that, I said, where do I know that name? Jonah Lehrer was a very successful science writer who his career came to a crashing halt after he was found to have plagiarized a lot of work. So I'm not casting doubt on the article. I haven't even read it yet. But here is a smart person writing about why smart people do dumb things. And somehow he let that happen in his own life.
Oh, perfect.
And Jack, wow. Jack, there are so many levels there we're not going to have time to go into here. But it really gets into, never trust the expert, as Marty said.
Yep.
But number two, it also gets into sort out the data or what's said.
Yep.
And separate that from the expert. That brilliant. Thanks for throwing that in there. And before I throw it over to Brian, I want to say something to our listening audience that struck me, and it always strikes me doing these shows, is the beauty of having a podcast like this is if there's anything in there that you find in here you find of value, if you didn't get it down in your notes, you can go back and look it up and find it. And I find that what I typically do a lot of times when I listen to podcasts, I'll note timestamps where someone said something. that I wanted to remember and go back to look up so it's easy to get back there. And with that, Brian, take us home.
Yeah, so I'll add another quote from another scientist, a physicist, Richard Feynman, said that science is the belief in the ignorance of experts. And so I think we're perhaps moving toward yet another fallacy that's listed on urologicalfallacies.com, and that is appeal to authority. So I think we've got some ideas of maybe some other fallacies we might be focused on in future episodes, but I think I'll go back to my recommendation, the STEAM-centered recommendations to close up on how to get better and better at reducing these fallacies and therefore, at least from my perspective, reducing abuse and enhancing civilization, and that is the SN STEAM, which is social support. Just want to again tell all of you on this podcast how much I appreciate your presence in my life because you are definitely part of my social support to decrease my poor thinking and increase my civility. You've been that for many, many years and really thankful for that. And I'm also thankful that through Vern, we've been able to put some of these conversations that I've been having with you all individually out into the world. So anybody else who wants to use us as a form of social support to clear up their thinking and enhance civilization is able to do that. So really appreciate you all and appreciate this journey into excellence. And that's how I'll end the day.
Well, folks, what a great show. I look forward to getting this one posted. My name is Vernon Bohr. I want to thank Marty, Brian, and Jack for this another great journey into excellence. We'll be back with you again next month. Until then, have a great day. Listen to this podcast. Let it empower you. And we look forward to meeting with you all